Disc 5.
40. Back at the U.S. Air Gate, Marino is seized by agitation and impetuosity. His flight has been delayed another hour due to weather. Suddenly, he doesn't want to go home to Trixie and get up in the morning and realize what happened in Boston. Thinking of his small house with its carport and its blue-collar neighborhood sinks his spirit lower into bitterness and a need to fight back. If only he could identify the enemy. Why he continues to live in Richmond makes no sense. Richmond is the past. Why he allowed Benton to blow him off makes no sense. He should never have walked away from Benton's apartment. "You know what due to weather means?" Marino asks the young red-headed woman sitting next to him, filing her nails. Two rude behaviors Marino simply can't tolerate are public farts and the scratching sound of manicures accompanied by drifting nail dust. The file continues to rapidly scratch, scratch. "It means they ain't decided whether to fly our asses out of Boston yet. See? There ain't enough passengers to make it worth their while. They lose money, they don't go nowhere and blame it on something else." The file freezes, and the woman looks around at dozens of empty plastic seats. "You can sit here all night," Marino goes on, "or come find a motel room with me." After a moment of disbelief, she gets up and walks off in a huff. "Pig," she says. Marino smiles, civility restored, his boredom assuaged, if only briefly. He is not going to wait for a flight that probably will never happen, and then he thinks of Benton again. Anger and paranoia ooze into his skull. His feeling of powerlessness and rejection settle more closely around him, choking him with a depression that stalls his thoughts and fatigues him as if he hasn't slept in days. He can't stand it. He won't. He wishes he could call Lucy, but doesn't know where she is. All she told him was that she had business to take care of that required traveling. "What business?" Marino asked her. "Just business. Sometimes I wonder why the hell I work for you." "I don't wonder about it in the least. I never give it a thought," Lucy said over the phone from her office in Manhattan. "You adore me." Outside Logan Airport, Marino flags down a Cambridge checker cab, practically stepping in front of it and waving his arms, ignoring the taxi line and the dozens of weary, unhappy people in it. "The embankment," he tells the driver. "Near where the band shell is." 41. Scarpetta doesn't know where Lucy is, either. Her niece doesn't answer her home or cell phones and hasn't returned numerous pages. Scarpetta can't reach Marino, and she has no intention of calling Rose and telling her about the letter. Her secretary worries too much already. Scarpetta sits on her bed, thinking. Billy makes his way up the dog ramp and plops down just far enough away to make her reach if she wants to pet him, and she does. "Why do you always sit so far away from me?" she talks to him as she stretches out to stroke his soft, floppy ears. "Oh, I get it. I'm supposed to reposition myself and move closer to you." She does. "You're a very willful dog, you know." Billy licks her hand. "I have to go out of town for a few days," she tells him, "but Rose will take good care of you. Maybe you'll stay at her house and she'll take you to the beach. So promise you won't get upset that I'm leaving." He never does. The only reason he comes running when she heads out on a trip is that he wants a ride in the car. He'd ride around in a car all day, given the choice. Scarpetta dials Lucy's office a second time. Although it is long past closing time, the phone is answered by an alive and awake human being 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Tonight it is Zach Manham's turn. "Okay, Zach," she says right off, "it's bad enough you won't tell me where Lucy is." "It's not that I won't tell." "Of course it is," she cuts him off. "You know, but you won't tell me." "I swear to God, I don't know," Manham replies. "Look, if I did, I'd call her on her international cell phone and at least tell her to call you." So she has her international cell phone with her. "Then she's out of the country?" "She always carries her international cell phone. You know, the one that takes photographs, videotapes, connects to the internet. She's got the latest model. It makes pizza." Nothing is funny to Scarpetta right now. "I tried her cell phone. She's not answering," she says, "whether she's in this country or some other one." "So what about Marino? You holding out on me about him, too?" I haven't talked to him in days, Manham says. No, I don't know where he is. He not answering his cell phone or pages either? No. Want me to take a polygraph, Doc? Yes. Manham laughs. Okay, I quit. I'm too tired to keep this up all night, Scarpetta says as she rubs Billy's tummy. If and when you ever hear from either one of them again, tell them to contact me immediately. It's urgent. Urgent enough that I'm flying to New York tomorrow. What, are you in danger? Manham asks, alarmed. I don't want to talk about it with you, Zack. No offense intended. Good night. She locks her bedroom door, sets the alarm, and places her pistol on the bedside table. 42. Marino doesn't like the taxi driver and asks him where he's from.
Kabul. Kabul's where, exactly? Marino asks. I mean, I know what country, he doesn't, but not its exact geographical location. Kabul is the capital of Afghanistan.
Marino tries to envision Afghanistan. All that comes to mind are dictators, terrorists, and camels.
And you do what there? I do nothing there. I live here.
The driver's dark eyes glance at him in the rearview mirror.
My family worked in the wool mills, and I came here 8 years ago. You should go to Kabul. It is very beautiful. Visit the old city. My name is Bebur. You have questions or need a cab, call my company and ask for me.
He smiles, his teeth gleaming white in the dark. Marino senses the driver is making fun of him, but he doesn't get the joke. The driver's identification card is fastened to the passenger's seat visor, and Marino tries to read it, but can't. His vision isn't what it used to be, and he refuses to wear glasses. Despite Scarpetta's urging, he also refuses laser surgery, which he adamantly claims will make him blind or damage his frontal lobe.
This way don't look familiar, Marino comments in his usual grumpy tone, as unrecognizable buildings flow past his window. We take a shortcut along the harbor, past the wharves, and then the causeway. Very pretty sights.
Marino leans forward on the hard bench seat, avoiding a spring that seems determined to work its way out of the vinyl upholstery and uncoil and bite his left buttock.
You're heading north, you Muhammad scumbag! I may not be from Boston, but I know where the embankment is, and you ain't even on the right side of the fucking river!
The cab driver, who calls himself Bebur, completely ignores his passenger and continues along his route, cheerfully pointing out the sights, including the Suffolk County Jail, the Massachusetts General Hospital, and the Shriners Burn Center. By the time he drops off Marino on Storrow Drive, close but not too close to Benton Wesley's apartment building, the meter registers $68.35. Marino slings open the door and throws a crumpled $1 bill into the front seat.
You owe me $67.35.
The taxi driver smooths open the dollar bill on his leg.
I will call the police. And I'll beat the shit out of you. And you can't do nothing about it because you ain't legal, right? Show me a green card, asshole, and guess what? I'm the police and got a pistol strapped under my arm.
He snatches out his wallet and flashes the badge he did not return to the Richmond Police Department after he retired. He said he lost it. Tires squeal as the taxi driver speeds off, screaming curses out his open window. Marino heads toward the Longfellow Bridge and veers off southeast, briefly following the same sidewalk he and Benton walked along earlier today. He takes a roundabout way beneath gas lamplight on Pinckney and Revere, constantly listening and checking his surroundings, making certain he isn't being followed, as is his habit. Marino isn't thinking about the Shandon cartel. He is on the lookout for the usual street punks and lunatics, although he has seen no evidence of either in this section of Beacon Hill. When Benton's building comes into view, Marino notices that the windows of Unit 56 are dark.
Shit,
he mutters, tossing his cigarette, not bothering to stamp it out. Benton must have gone out for a late dinner, or to the gym, or for a jog. But that isn't likely, and Marino's anxieties tighten his chest with his every step. He knows damn well that Benton would not leave lights on when he goes out. He isn't the sort to walk into a completely dark house or apartment. Climbing the stairs to the fifth floor is worse than last time, because adrenaline and beer quicken his straining heart until he can scarcely breathe. When he reaches Unit 56, he bangs on the door. Not a sound comes from inside. He pounds harder and calls out, "Yo! Tom!" 43. Lucy starts the Mercedes and suddenly stares at Rudy in the pitch dark. "Oh my God! I can't believe it!" She pounds the steering wheel with her fist, accidentally blaring the horn. "What?" Rudy jumps, startled and suddenly frantic. "What the hell? What the hell are you doing?" "My tactical baton. Goddamn son of a bitch. I left it on the night table inside the room. It's going to have my fingerprints on it, Rudy." How could she make such a brain-dead mistake? All went according to plan until she made an oversight, a mindless blunder, the very sort of blunder that catches people on the run all the time. The engine rumbles quietly on the side of the dark street. Neither Lucy nor Rudy quite sure what to do. They are free. They got away with it. No one near or inside the hotel saw them, and now one of them must go back. "I'm sorry," Lucy whispers. "I'm a fucking idiot," she says. "You stay here."
"No, I'll take care of it."
Rudy's fear turns to the more manageable emotion of rage, and he resists taking it out on her. "I fucked it up. I get to fix it." She swings open the car door. 44. Bev Kiffin runs her fingers through a rack of cheap acetate panties and bras. The women's lingerie section of Walmart is near Arts and Crafts and directly across from Men's Athletic Shoes, a section of the store she frequently haunts. She is certain, however, that the clerks in their cheap blue vests and name tags don't recognize her. This is the type of business where tired, glazed employees don't pay much attention to common-looking people like Bev, who root around for bargains in a discount store that is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. A red lacy bra captivates her imagination, and she checks sizes, looking for a 38D. Finding one in black, she tucks it up a sleeve of her dark green rain slicker. The bra is followed by two pairs of bikini-cut panties, size large. Stealing lingerie and other items that do not have security sensors is so easy. She wonders why everybody doesn't do it. Bev has no fear of consequences. No frontal lobe alarm sounds when she contemplates committing a crime, no matter how serious. Opportunities come and go on her radar screen, some bigger and brighter than others, such as the woman who has just wandered into the arts and crafts section, interested in needlepoint. The thought of such a stupid domestic hobby fills Bev with contempt as she instantly deduces that the attractive blonde dressed in jeans and a light blue jacket is naive. A lamb. Bev continues rummaging through the lingerie rack, the target on her radar flashing brighter with each passing second, her pulse picking up, her palms getting clammy. The woman drops skeins of colorful floss and a needlepoint pattern of an eagle and a flag into her cart. So she's patriotic, Bev thinks. Maybe she has a husband or boyfriend in the military. Might be gone. Maybe still in Iraq. She's at least 35, maybe close to 40. Could be her man's in the National Guard. The cart rolls forward, getting closer. Bev detects cologne. The scent is unfamiliar and probably expensive. The woman's legs are slender, her posture good. She works out in the gym. She's got free time on her hands. If she has children, she must be able to afford having someone take care of them while she's trotting off to the gym, or maybe the hair salon. Bev scans a scrap of paper, a shopping list, feigning that she is unaware of the woman, who pauses in the aisle, looking directly at the rack of lingerie. She wants to keep her man happy. A lamb. Good-looking. An air about her that Bev associates with intelligence. She can sense when people are smart. They don't have to say one word because the rest of them is talking. The woman pushes her cart straight to the rack, not even a foot from where Bev is standing, and the perfume crawls up Bev's sinuses, burrowing way up inside her skull, and her focus sharpens to a point as the woman unzips her jacket, picks a sheer red bra off the rack and holds it up to firm, ample breasts. Hatred and envy electrify every nerve and muscle in Bev's matronly body, her upper lip breaking out in a cold sweat. She wanders in the direction of men's running shoes as the woman dials a cell phone. It rings somewhere for several seconds.
"Honey," she sweetly, happily says. "Still here. I know, such a big place." She laughs. "I like the Walmart off Acadian better." She laughs again. "Well, maybe I will, if you're sure you don't mind."
She holds out her left arm, glancing at the watch peeking out of her sleeve, the sort of watch runners wear. Bev expected something fancier. 45. A light, misty rain dampens the streets of Szczecin as Lucy nears the Radisson Hotel. This time she doesn't have to wait for the clerk to leave the front desk. The lobby is deserted. She walks inside, casually but briskly, and heads to the elevators. Her finger is about to make contact with the elevator button when the doors part, and a very intoxicated man lurches out, knocking into her.
"Excuse me," he says loudly, startling Lucy and jerking her mind out of gear.
What to do? What to do?
"Now, aren't you the prettiest thing I've seen forever?"
His words slur as if his mouth is numb with lidocaine, and he is almost yelling as he leers at her, checking her out from her hair to her cleavage to her satin cowboy boots. He announces that his party is going strong in room 301 and she must come. He goes on and on. My, my, how beautiful and sexy she is, and obviously American, and he was from Chicago, transferred recently to Germany, and is lonely and separated from his wife, who is a bitch. The desk clerk rushes back to the lobby, and not a minute later a security guard follows and speaks in English to the drunk.
"Perhaps you should go back to your room. It is late, and you should go to sleep," he says stiffly, eyeing Lucy with distaste and suspicion, as if assuming she is the vulgar man's girlfriend or perhaps a prostitute, and is probably drunk, too.
She stabs at the elevator button, missing it several times, swaying and clutching the drunk man's arm.
"Come on, baby. Let's go," she slurs with a Russian accent, leaning against him.
"Now, ain't that sweet?"
He is about to show besotted surprise and pleasure in her company when she reaches up and kisses him hard on the mouth. The elevator doors open, and she pulls him inside, wrapping herself around him and continuing a long, tongue-groping kiss that tastes like garlic and whiskey. The security guard stares stonily at them as the doors shut. Mistake. The guard will remember her face. Lucy's face is hard to forget, and the guard had plenty of time to look at it because Lucy was trapped with the drunk asshole. Big mistake. She hits button two as the man paws her. He doesn't seem to notice that the elevator is stopping at the wrong floor, but suddenly his new lover is running away, clutching at her clothes. He tries to chase after her, wildly waving his arms, cursing, catching his toe on the carpet and stumbling. Lucy follows exit signs, turning into another hallway, then into a stairway. She silently makes her way up three flights and waits on the dimly lit landing, holding her breath and listening, sweat rolling down her face and soaking her sexy black blouse. Possibly it was habit, more than instinct, that caused her to pluck up a plastic hotel key from the table in Caggiano's room and tuck it in a pocket of her windbreaker. Whenever she checks out of a hotel, she always keeps a key, if it is a disposable one, in the event she suddenly realizes she has forgotten something. Once, and she doesn't like to remember this, she left her gun in a bedside drawer and didn't realize it until she was climbing into a taxi. Thank God she still had a key. The Do Not Disturb sign hangs ominously from the doorknob of room 511, and Lucy searches the hallway, desperately hoping she is not surprised by anyone else. As she makes her approach, she faintly hears the television inside Rocco's room, and a sick pain stabs her stomach. Fear burns. Recalling what she and Rudy just did is awful, and now she must confront their sin again. A green light flickers, and she pushes open the door with her elbows because she has no fresh gloves, having raced off without them. She runs into a wall of rank smell from Rocco's last greasy meal and detects his alcohol-saturated blood. It coagulates like pudding under his head, his eyes half open and dull, the chair overturned, the gun under his chest, every detail exactly as she and Rudy had left it. Blowflies buzz around his body, searching for the perfect piece of moist human real estate to appropriate for their eggs. Lucy stares transfixed at the frenzied insects. She focuses on her tactical baton. It, too, is exactly as she left it, on the table to the left of the bed. "Oh, thank God," she mutters. The baton is safely back up her sleeve as she cautiously opens the door, wiping the knob with her blouse. This time she takes the stairs all the way down to the service level where she hears the murmur of voices, possibly from the kitchen. Along walls are carts loaded with dirty dishes, wilted flowers in bud vases, empty wine bottles, and what is left from cocktails and other beverages. Food is hardened on hotel china and stains white cloths and wadded napkins. There are no flies down here. Not one. She swallows repeatedly, suddenly nauseous as she envisions the blowflies crawling all over Rocco and feeding on his gore. She thinks about what will happen next. Inside his warm room, blowfly eggs will hatch into maggots that, depending on how long he remains undiscovered, will teem over his decomposing body, especially inside his wound and other orifices. Blowflies love deep, dark, moist crevices and passageways. The intense presence of carrion predators will throw off Rocco's time of death, as intended when Rudy introduced the flies into the room. The forensic pathologist who examines Rocco's body will be confused by the story of when room service delivered his late dinner and the advanced stage of maggot infestation and decomposition. His blood alcohol level will indicate that Caggiano was intoxicated when he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound that penetrated his temple and tore through his brain in a storm of lead shrapnel and the ragged, razor-sharp copper edges of a semi-jacketed hollow-point bullet. Prints on the gun will be his. The warmth of the room will be factored in, but should not arouse suspicion. The empty champagne bottle has Caggiano's prints on it, should the police bother to check, although there will be no record of his ordering the champagne or receiving it, compliments of the manager. He could have bought it elsewhere. The red notice will have his prints on it, should anyone bother to check, and she must assume someone will. She wishes Rocco had not ordered room service, but she planned for that possibility, realizing that whoever delivered his dinner will recall the tip and not want to reveal that it was American cash. He or she will not want to be implicated in any sort of scandal that involves the police. In addition, if Rocco's time of death, as determined by the forensic pathologist, doesn't jibe at all with what the hotel employee who delivered the room service has to say, assuming the person talks, then it may very well be assumed that the person is mistaken about the time, possibly even the day, or is lying. No one in that hotel will want to admit to accepting American money, and who knows what other favors and contraband that Rocco, a fugitive, has probably bestowed on them over the many years he has stayed in that hotel. Who will care that Rocco Caggiano is dead? Perhaps no one except the Chandon family. They will wonder. Lucy plotted with the expectation that they will press hard to know the facts. Maybe they will. Maybe they won't. Suicide will be accepted, and no one will feel grief or even give a damn. 46. Lucy sprints through the dark, her aching chest not due to physical exertion. The Mercedes is quiet on the side of the street, and she can't see Rudy through the tinted windows. The locks click free, and she opens the driver's door. "Mission accomplished?" he grimly asks in the dark. "Don't start the car yet." She tells him about her encounter with the drunk and the hotel staff and explains the way she handled it. He says nothing. She feels his disapproval and irritation with her. "Give me some credit. I think we're fine."
"As fine as you could be under the circumstances," he has to admit.
"There's no reason for anyone to connect me with Rocco's room, with his death," she goes on. "I guarantee that hotel staff won't touch his room with that do not disturb sign on the door. More flies will come in through the opening in the window. Say he's found in 3 or 4 days. Maggots will have devoured him to the point he won't be recognizable. And in case you don't know it, blowflies are attracted to shit, too. And his blood alcohol level will be high. No reason in the world for anyone to think anything but suicide, and the hotel will want his rotting body and maggots out of there as quickly as possible. And the medical examiner will think he's been dead longer than room service says, assuming there is an exact time associated with Rocco's dinner order, and there probably won't be. Orders aren't handled by computer, I know that for a fact.
For a fact? Rudy asks. How the hell can you know that for a fact?
What do you think I am, fucking stupid? I called days ago. Said I was a Hewlett-Packard rep checking on their computers and that the one the kitchen used for room service needed a software upgrade. And they didn't know what I was talking about, said they didn't use computers for room service, only for inventory. Then I talked about the advantages of using an HP Pavilion 753 with an Intel Pentium processor and 80 GB and CD-ROM and all the rest for room service orders. Point is, there is no computer record of what time Rocco ordered dinner, okay?
Rudy was silent, then said, They use Hewlett-Packards at that hotel?
Easy enough to find out by calling the business office, yes, she replied.
Okay, good job on that one. So even if the drunk or anyone else paid any attention to you, the way we've staged Rocco's crime scene will make it appear he was dead long before you went off to party with the drunk.
That's right, Rudy. We're fine. We're fine. Rocco's already being infested. Masses of maggots will produce heat and speed up decomposition, and it looks like a suicide anyway. One committed earlier, much earlier than anyone will imagine.
She starts the car, laying a hand on his arm.
Now, can we get the hell out of here?
We can't make any more mistakes, Lucy, he says in a defeated way. We just can't.
She pulls away from the sidewalk, angry.
The fact is, at least two people in that hotel think you might be a drunk convention goer or maybe even a prostitute, and you aren't easy to forget, no matter what they think you are. It probably doesn't matter one goddamn bit, but...
He doesn't finish. But it could have. Lucy drives carefully, checking her mirrors and the sidewalks, dark with shadows.
Right, it could have.
She feels his eyes and the shifting of his moods. He is softening toward her, sorry he was so rough.
Hey, you Rudy, you.
She reaches out and affectionately touches his cheek, his stubble reminding her of a cat's tongue.
We're on the go and we're okay.
She reaches for his hand and holds it tightly. This went down bad, Rudy, really bad, but it's going to turn out fine. We're fine, she says again. When one or the other or both of them are scared, they never admit it, but they know because they need each other. Each becomes desperate for the other's warm flesh. Lucy lifts his hand to her mouth, resting his arm against her.
Don't, he says. We're both tired, strung out. Not a good time to not have both hands on the wheel. Lucy, don't, he mutters, as she deeply kisses his fingers, his knuckles, his palm.
She makes love to one hand and slides the other inside her black linen blouse.
Lucy, stop. Oh, Jesus. It's not fair.
He unfastens his seatbelt.
I don't want to feel this way about you, goddammit.
Lucy drives.
You do feel it for me. At least sometimes, don't you?
Lucy pets his hair, his neck, slips her hand into his collar and traces the muscles of his upper back. She doesn't look at him as she drives fast. 47. Several times Nick sent memos to the Baton Rouge task force, reminding the men and women, mostly men, that a Walmart or other huge store like it would be a very good place for a killer to stalk his victims. No one would pay any attention to a vehicle in the parking lot, no matter the hour, and based on charge card receipts, every one of the missing women shopped at Walmart. If not the one closest to the Louisiana State University campus, then at others in Baton Rouge and New Orleans. Ivy Ford did. The Saturday before she disappeared, she drove from Zachary and stopped at this very Walmart, the one near LSU. The task force never responded directly to Nick, but someone associated with it must have called her chief, because he found her in the break room before she took off to Knoxville and said, out of nowhere,
"Most everybody in the world shops at Walmart's, Sam's Clubs, Kmart's, Costco's, and so on, Nick."
"Yes, sir," she said. "Most everybody does."
Baton Rouge isn't her jurisdiction, and the only way she might change that fact would be for the Attorney General to say the hell with boundaries. She has no good reason to request this, and he would have no good reason to grant it. Nick has never been the sort to ask permission unless the subject rises before her like a drawbridge, giving her no choice but to put on the brakes or turn around. These days she works undercover wherever her instincts take her, which frequently is the Walmart near LSU, close to where her father lives in the old Garden District. It isn't difficult to intuit which area of the store a killer might frequent if he is looking for prey. Women's lingerie would excite him, especially if a potential victim was holding up bras and panties, checking out styles and sizes, as that fleshy woman with short graying hair was doing moments earlier, before leaving the store with stolen merchandise tucked up the sleeve of her raincoat. The petty thievery will go unreported because Nick has a much bigger agenda. She leaves her shopping cart in the aisle and walks out of the store, aware of every man she spots, aware of his awareness and activity, and acutely conscious of the pistol in her fanny pack. Outside, the parking lot is fairly well lit by tall lamps. What few cars there are, less than 100, are parked close together, as if to keep one another company. She spots the heavy-set petty thief walking swiftly toward a dark blue Chevrolet with Louisiana tags. Nick memorizes the plate number as she heads in the woman's general direction without appearing to notice her. In fact, Nick doesn't notice anyone in the area who might be a potential serial killer. If the woman is being stalked, and of course that was a long shot to begin with, there is no hint of it. Once again, Nick is prodded by guilt because she is disappointed. The idea that she could possibly feel regret that a woman is not about to become another victim is so abhorrent that Nick will not acknowledge her sinful hopes to anyone, and scarcely to herself. She represses that truth so completely that she would probably pass a polygraph test if the examiner asked her, "Do you feel disappointed when you tail a potential victim and the killer doesn't try to abduct her or succeed in abducting her?" Nick wouldn't get tense or hesitate. Her pulse rate would stay the same as she replies, "No." The shorter the answer, the less chance of her nervous system betraying her. She does not walk anywhere near her own car, a 5-year-old forest green Ford Explorer that is clandestinely equipped with a portable dash-mounted flashing beacon, a shotgun, a first aid kit, jumper cables, flares, a fire extinguisher, a jump-out bag containing battle dress uniforms, boots, extra magazines, and other tactical gear, a handheld scanner tucked under the dash, and a charger for her international cell phone, which also works as a two-way radio. A lot of her equipment she bought with her own money. In life, she is always overprepared for the worst. The woman digs inside a dirty canvas beach bag, maybe 10 feet from the Chevrolet. Certainly, she doesn't fit the victimology, not in the least. But Nick doesn't trust so-called patterns or M.O.s. She remembers Scarpetta emphasizing that profiles are dangerous because they're fraught with errors. Not everybody does everything the same way every time, and if nothing else, the woman is a loner in a dark, relatively deserted parking lot at the edge of a major university campus, and that makes her vulnerable to predators. The woman fumbles with keys and drops them. Stooping to pick them up, she loses her balance and falls, suddenly crying out and clutching her left knee. She casts about helplessly, spots Nick, and begs, "Help me!" Nick sprints and squats by the woman. "Don't move," she tells her. "What hurts?" She smells insect repellent and body odor. It vaguely brushes against her thoughts that the car keys on the pavement don't look as if they belong to a relatively new Chevrolet. "I think I pulled something in my knee," the woman says, her eyes fixed on Nick's. "It's my bad knee." Her accent is southern with a distinct lilt. She is not native to the area, and her hands are rough and raw, as if she is accustomed to hard physical work such as cleaning or shucking shellfish. Nick notices no jewelry, not even a watch. The woman pulls up her pant leg and looks at an angry purple bruise centered on her kneecap. The bruise isn't fresh. Instinctively, Nick is repulsed by the woman's unpleasant odor, her bad breath, and something about her demeanor that she can't pinpoint but finds disturbing. She gets to her feet and steps back.
"I can call an ambulance," Nick says. "Not much else I can do, ma'am. I'm not a doctor."
A look takes over the woman's face, making it harsher in the glow of the parking lot lamps.
"No, I don't need an ambulance. Like I said, I have this happen all the time."
She tries to get up.
"Then why do you have just one bruise?"
"I always fall the same way."
Nick keeps her distance. She has no intention of offering further assistance. The woman is dirty, maybe mentally ill, and Nick knows better than to tangle with that type. They can be contagious, unpredictable, even violent if one has physical contact with them. The woman is on her feet now, favoring her left leg.
"Believe I'll get me a coffee and rest for a bit," she says. "I'll be fine, just fine."
Slowly she limps away from the Chevrolet, back toward the store. Nick softens. She digs in a pocket of her jeans as she trots after the woman.
"Here."
She hands her a $5 bill. The woman smiles, her quick dark eyes hot on Nick's.
"God bless you." She clutches the money. "You're a lamb," she says.
48. The door across the hallway opens, and an older man in an undershirt and sweatpants studies Marino suspiciously.
"What's all the racket about?"
he inquires, his gray hair sticking up like the bristles of a hedgehog, his wrinkled face patchy with stubble, his eyes puffy and bloodshot. Marino knows the look all too well. The man's been drinking, probably since he got up and downed his first eye-opener.
"You seen Tom?" Marino asks, sweating and struggling for air.
"Can't say I really know him. Don't have a heart attack. I can't do CPR, although I am familiar with the Heimlich maneuver."
"He promised to meet me," Marino catches a breath. "And I came all the friggin' way from California."
"You did?"
The man is very curious now and steps out into the hallway.
"What for?"
"What do you mean, what for?"
Marino recovers enough to snap at him, as if it is any of the man's business.
"'Cause the friggin' gold rush's over. 'Cause I'm tired of sitting on the friggin' dock of the bay. 'Cause I got bored being a friggin' movie star."
"If you were in the movies, I've never seen you, and I rent movies all the time. What else is there to do around here?"
"Have you seen Tom?"
Marino persists, trying in vain to force the knob by turning it hard and shaking the door.
"I was asleep when you started all the racket," says the man, who looks at least 60 and a bit deranged. "I haven't seen Tom and don't care for the likes of him, if you get my drift."
He scrutinizes Marino.
"What do you mean, the likes of him?
Homo. That's news to me. Not that I give a shit what people do, as long as I ain't around to see it. He bringin' men to his apartment or something? 'Cause I'm not sure I want to get in if—"
"Oh, no, never saw him bring anybody to his apartment. But another homo in the building who wears leather and earrings told me he's seen Tom in some of those bars where homos go and pick each other up for a quick visit to the bathroom."
"Listen, jerkface. I'm supposed to be subletting this dump from the son of a bitch,"
Marino heatedly informs the man.
"Already paid him the first 3 months' rent, and drove from California to get the key and move in. All my stuff's down there in my damn truck."
"That would really piss me off."
"No joke, Sherlock."
"I mean, really piss me off. Who's Sherlock?"
"Oh, yes, that detective with the hat and pipe. I don't read violent books."
"So if you hear any noise coming from this apartment, ignore it. If I have to use dynamite, I'm getting in."
"You don't really mean that," the old man worries.
"Right,"
Marino says sarcastically.
"I walk around with dynamite in my pockets. I'm a suicide bomber with a New Jersey accent. Know how to fly planes, just can't take off or land."
The old man disappears inside his apartment, and a burglar chain rattles. 49. Marino studies the hollow metal door of Unit 56. Some 12 inches above the knob is a deadbolt lock. He lights a cigarette, squinting through smoke at the enemy. A cheap brass knob with a push-button lock and the more problematic single-cylinder deadbolt. None of the other doors along the hallway have deadbolts, confirming Marino's suspicion that Benton installed the lock himself. Knowing him, he opted for a jimmy-proof deadbolt that neither a thief nor a hitman nor an aggravated Marino can drill through without a spring-actuated plate sliding shut like a bank window and foiling the drill bit. One security risk that Benton couldn't have done much about was the door frame, which is a thin strip of metal screwed into wood.
"Piece of cake,"
Marino says to himself as he unsnaps a buck tool from his belt and slides it out of its worn leather sheath. The hinges are the common loose pin variety, and Marino unfolds a pair of pliers from his all-purpose tool, attacks the pin, and works it out of the hinge like a cork out of a bottle. Soon, 3 pins are on the floor, the door free on the left side. With 2 powerful yanks, Marino breaks the locks loose from the metal jamb. Inside the apartment, he props the door against the opening to give himself a little privacy. He flips on the overhead lights. Benton had moved out, leaving nothing behind but food in the cupboards, a refrigerator full of Budweiser, and half a bag of trash in the kitchen. "May as well grab a beer while I'm here," Marino thinks. The bottle opener is on the counter where Marino saw it last, seeming to welcome him in a generous, affectionate way like a Christmas stocking. Nothing else is out of place. Even the dishwasher is empty. Strange. Benton was careful not to offer so much as a partial fingerprint on window panes, tabletops, or drinking glasses, dishes, cookware, or silverware. Marino continues to hold up objects and look at them in oblique light. Sweep marks of the vacuum cleaner are visible on the carpet. Benton wiped down the entire place, and when Marino digs through the garbage bag, he finds nothing but his own empty Budweiser bottles and the broken glass from the Dos Equis he smashed in the sink. Every piece of glass is clean, the labels wet and soapy.
"What the hell is going on?" Marino asks the living room.
"I don't know," a male voice answers from behind the propped-up door. "Everything all right in there?"
Marino recognizes the neighbor from across the hall.
"Go to bed," he gruffly tells him. "And if you and me are going to get along, you need to mind your own business. What's your name?"
"Dave." "That's funny, I'm Dave, too. As in T-O, not T-W-O.
T-O-O. Sorry, I forgot to bring spell check with me."
Marino glares through the space between the propped-up door and the frame. Dave appears more curious than frightened, peering in, trying to look around the room. Marino's considerable size blocks the nosy neighbor's view.
"Can't believe the bastard left like this," Marino says. "How'd you like to break into your own damn apartment?"
"I wouldn't. Not only that, the joint's a pig pen, and he made off with the silverware, pots and pans, and every bar of soap and roll of toilet paper."
"Silverware and cookware belong to the apartment," Dave says disapprovingly. "But from where I'm looking, the place looks quite tidy."
"Yeah, from where you're looking."
"I always thought he was an odd man. I wonder why he took the toilet paper."
"I only hooked up with him a couple months back, answering his ad for subletting," Marino comments.
He straightens up and steps away from the door, scanning the inside of the apartment again as Dave peers in. His eyes are red-rimmed and glassy, his cheeks sagging and rosy with broken blood vessels, probably from years of living inside a whiskey bottle.
"Yep," he says. "He never talked. I mean, never. Not even when he passed me in the hall or we both just happened to open our doors at the same time. There we are, face to face, and the most he ever did was sort of give me a little smile and a jerk of his chin."
Marino isn't a great believer in coincidences and suspects Dave listened for Benton to come and go and just happened to open his door when Benton was opening his.
"Where were you this afternoon?"
Marino wonders if Dave heard the altercation, a loud one coming from Benton's apartment.
"Oh, I don't know. After lunch, I sleep a lot.
Drunk, Marino thinks.
He's the sort who didn't have friends, Dave goes on.
Marino continues looking around, standing near the door while Dave peers through the crack.
Never saw him have a single visitor, and I've been living here 5 years. 5 years and 2 months. Hate this place. He seemed to go away sometimes. Since I retired from being the head chef at the lobster house, I have to watch my pennies.
Marino has no idea how watching pennies has anything to do with the man's mysterious neighbor.
You was the head chef there? Every time I come to Boston, I eat at the lobster house.
This isn't true, nor is Marino a frequent visitor to Boston.
You and the rest of the world, yes, sir. Well, I wasn't the head chef, but I damn well should have been. I'll cook for you one of these days. How long did the weirdo live here?
Oh, Dave sighs, his eyes shining through the space as he watches Marino.
I'd say going on 2 years, on and off. What was your favorite dish at the lobster house? 2 damn years. That's interesting. Told me he'd just moved in and gotten transferred or something, which is why he had to give up the apartment. Well, probably lobster, Dave remarks. All tourists get the lobster and sop it in so much butter it's a wonder they taste anything but butter. So I was always commenting to the other workers in the kitchen what was the point of bringing in nice fresh lobsters if nobody tastes anything but the butter.
I hate seafood,
Marino says.
Well, we do have mighty fine steaks. Aged 100% prime Angus.
Aged always worries me. In the grocery store, aged means spoiled. You know, clearance buggy shit.
Now, he wasn't here all the time, Dave says. In and out, sometimes gone for weeks. But no way he'd just moved in. I've seen him coming in and out for 2 years, like I said.
Anything else you can tell me about this homo who locked me out and made off with half the stuff in the joint?
Marino asks.
When I find him, I'm gonna kick his ass.
Dave shakes his head and disappointment glints.
Sure wish I could help you out, but like I've been saying, I didn't know the man, and I'm glad he's gone. And it's looking like you and me will be great neighbors, Dave, too.
Thick as thieves. Now you go on to bed. Let me get a few things done in here, and I'll catch you later.
So nice to meet you. I guess I'll be calling you Dave, too, from now on, if that's okay with you.
Nighty-night.
50. Benton lived here 2 years, and nobody knew him, not even his lonely, busybody neighbor, Dave. Not that Marino is really surprised, but the realization is a reminder of Benton's desolate, confining life, which is all the more reason his refusal to return to himself, his friends, and those who love him makes no sense. Marino sits on Benton's perfectly made bed, staring in a glazed way at the mirror over the dresser. As well as Benton knows him, he must have suspected that Marino would come back and rant and rail at him again. Not much could be more wounding than for him to have said he doesn't want to see Marino again, ever. He focuses on his big, unhealthy self in the mirror, sweat rolling down his face, and it occurs to him that Benton turned off the air conditioning in the living room when he and Benton were arguing. But when Marino just broke in, the air conditioning was back on in that room but turned off in this one. Virtually every move Benton makes is deliberate. That's the way he is. And for him to crank the air conditioning on high in the living area and turn it off in the bedroom was for a reason. Marino gets off the bed and walks to the window unit, noticing an envelope taped to the side of it. Perfectly centered on it in block letters are the initials P.M. Excitement kicks in, but is tempered by Marino's wariness. He returns to the kitchen for a sharp knife. Back in the bedroom, he sets it on top of the air conditioning unit. Then he heads to the bathroom and yanks off several long sections of toilet paper, wrapping it around his fingers. He returns to the window unit and carefully removes the envelope, noticing that both ends of the tape are folded over so that they adhere to themselves, the same technique police use to prevent fingerprint tape from sticking to their gloves. He slits the top of the envelope and pulls out a folded sheet of plain white paper and smooths it open. Written in the same block printing that's on the envelope is, "Please keep on." Baffled, Marino considers for a moment that the note wasn't intended for him and wasn't written by Benton. He considers that neither the tape nor the paper is old, and they are very clean, and the folded ends of the tape hint that whoever used it might have been wearing latex gloves. Marino's initials are PM, and Benton knows that handwriting comparisons are usually foiled by block printing, unless a document's examiner is comparing block printing exemplars written by the same individual. Benton also knows that Marino would be hot as hell in this room and would turn on the air conditioner. Or if nothing else, Marino would notice the inconsistency of one window unit left on while the other isn't, and would wonder about it. "Keep on the air conditioner?" Marino says out loud, frustrated and exhausted. He returns to the kitchen and snatches open a cupboard where a few minutes earlier he noticed a neat, tidy stack of small paper grocery bags. Shaking one open, he drops the envelope inside it.
"What the hell are you talking about? Are you just fucking with me, you son of a bitch?"
Frustration tightens his chest as he thinks of the way Benton treated him, as if the two of them hadn't been lifelong friends, buddies, almost like brothers, sharing the same woman but in entirely different ways. In a fantastic and secret part of Marino's mind, he and Benton were married to Scarpetta at the same time. Now Marino has exclusive rights to her, but she doesn't long for him, and that repressed anguish adds to his volatility, his upset. A flutter of panic stirs in his stomach and floats up his throat. Outside in the dark, without a cab in sight, Marino lights a cigarette and weakly sits on a brick wall, breathing hard, his heart pounding violently against his ribs like a boxer pounding him, battering him, knocking the wind out of him. Pain shoots through the left side of his chest, terrifying him, and he takes slow, deep, sharp breaths but can't get enough air. An empty taxicab drives by, seems to drift by, as sweat drips from Marino's face while he sits perfectly still on the wall, eyes wide, hands on his knees. The cigarette drops from his clamped fingers and rolls on cobblestones, stopping in a crack. 51. Bev can't stop thinking about her. She should stay far away from that lamb who just gave her $5 in the Walmart parking lot, but she can't. Bev can't control the compulsion, and although her reaction defies any rational explanation, there is a cause and effect in her black, ugly thoughts. The lamb spurned her. The woman backed away from Bev as if she was repulsive and then dared to degrade her further by giving her money. Inside Walmart, Bev lingers near a display of insect repellents, picking up bottles, pretending to read the labels as she watches the parking lot through the plate glass. To her surprise, the lamb isn't driving a new car, but an old forest green Explorer that for some reason doesn't seem in character for a spoiled rich housewife or girlfriend. More interesting yet, she's sitting inside the SUV with the engine running and the headlights off. Bev is in and out of a dressing room in 5 minutes, outfitted in a loud Hawaiian shirt and Bermuda shorts, none of it paid for, and the sensors cut off with her buck knife. Her rain slicker is inside out and draped over her arm, a cheap plastic rain bonnet over her hair, even though the night is clear. If people notice her at all, they will assume she is either crazy or processing her hair. The Explorer hasn't moved. Bev walks directly to Jay's beat-up, filthy white SUV, confident the lamb doesn't notice her, or at least doesn't connect her with the woman she encountered and gave money to not even half an hour ago. Driving off, Bev turns left onto Perkins, then crosses Acadian and parks in a small parking lot filled with cars, because Catery is a popular restaurant, especially with university students. She turns off her engine and headlights, waiting, her desire burning hotter the longer the lamb sits in the forest green Explorer in the Walmart parking lot across the street. Maybe she is on the phone. Maybe this time she is fighting with her man instead of sounding so disgustingly sweet. Bev is an expert at tailing people. She does it regularly when she is driving Jay's Cherokee. Before she began biding her time as a fugitive at a fishing camp, she followed people, depending on what needed to be done or just for the hell of it. But in those days her activities had a purpose, or at least were a means directed toward a useful end. Whatever Bev did, she was following orders. To some extent, she is following Jay's orders now, but methods and emotions change when one is asked repeatedly to perform the same task. Bev has begun to indulge herself, entertain her own fantasies, and have her own fun. It's her right. The explorer heads into the heart of the old garden district. The pretty blonde driver has no idea that the woman with the bad knee is not far behind. This amuses Bev. She smiles as the explorer slows down and makes a right turn into a dark driveway bordered by tall shrubs. Bev drives past, pulls off the road, and gets out. She quickly covers herself in her dark rain slicker and backtracks to the white brick house just in time to see its front door close, the woman safely inside. Bev returns to her Cherokee, writes down the address, and cuts across a side road so she doesn't pass the house again. She waits. 52. More than anything, Jean-Baptiste Chandon wants a dipole antenna, but he is not allowed commissary privileges, and the commissary is where the antennas are sold. Inmates who enjoy favored status can buy dipole antennas, headphones, portable radios, an AM-FM booster, and a religious medal with a chain. At least some inmates can. Beast, in particular, loves to boast about his portable radio, but he does not own a dipole antenna because inmates are allowed only one item from a special list of the Big Ten, as they call it. On death row, privileges are limited out of fear of inmates fashioning weapons. Jean-Baptiste does not care about a weapon. His body is his weapon, should he ever decide to uncoil it. Uncoiling it is of no interest, not now. When he is led in restraints to the shower, he has no need to attack officers, which he could most assuredly do because of his magnetism, which is only enhanced when he is led past multiple metal doors with iron bars. His power builds. It throbs in his groin and lifts the top of his skull to a hover above his head. He leaves a visible trail of sparks. The corrections officers never understand what he smiles about, and his demeanor greatly annoys them. Lights out was at 9. The officer in the control booth enjoys flipping every switch and throwing the inmates into complete darkness in the pod. Jean-Baptiste has overheard officers comment that darkness gives the dirtbags time to think hard about their impending executions, the punishment for what they did when they were on the outside, free and able to satisfy their love. Those who do not kill do not understand that the ultimate union with a woman is to release her, to hear her scream and moan, to cover himself with her blood as he ravishes her body and then poses her, that all people might see and therefore share in her ecstasy and the marriage of her magnetism to him for all eternity. He lies on his bunk, sweat soaking through the sheets, his odor filling his small airless cell, the stainless steel toilet a toadstool shape against the right side of the back wall. The condemned inmates are quiet, with the exception of Beast. He talks quietly to himself, almost whispers, not realizing that Jean-Baptiste can hear without ears. Beast is transformed at night into the powerless, weak entity that he really is. He will be so much better off when the cocktail settles him to sleep, and he no longer needs his weak, flawed flesh.
Hold still. It's nice, isn't it? Feels so nice. Stop it. Please, stop it. Stop it. That hurts. Don't cry. This feels good. Don't you understand, you little bitch? It feels good.
I want my mommy.
So do I, but she's a whore. Now you quit crying, you hear me? You scream one more time.
Who's there?
Jean-Baptiste asks the foul-smelling air.
Shut up. Shut the fuck up. It's your fault. You had to scream, didn't you? When I told you not to. Well, no more chewing gum for you. Cinnamon. Dropping the wrapper by the swing set so I know what flavor you like. Stupid little cunt. You stay right here in the shade, okay? I've got to run. Got to run. How's that for a good one? I got to run, got to run, got to run.
He begins to softly sing.
Got to run, got to run, got to run, run, run.
Who's there?
Knock, knock, who's there?
Beast calls back in a searing, mocking tone.
Harry, Harry, quite contrary, how does your dickie grow? With little nuts hiding in your butt and a weenie smaller than your nose.
Softly, softly singing, but loud enough.
I'm a poet, don't you know it?
You know that dickless wonder? A real sensitive guy I am. Green eggs and ham, Cat in the Hat. I like 'em meaty, but not too fat. A drum roll, please.
Who's there?
Jean-Baptiste bares his widely spaced, tiny pointed teeth. He licks them hard and tastes the salty metallic flavor of his own blood.
Just me, Hairball. Your best pal in the world. Your only pal in the world. You got nobody but me, you know that? You must. Who else talks to you and sends little love notes door to door to door until it's slid under yours all dirty and read by everybody?
Jean-Baptiste listens, sucking blood out of his tongue.
You got this powerful family. I heard all about it on my radio. More'n once I heard it.
Silence. Jean-Baptiste's ears are satellite dishes.
Connections. Where are those fucking guards when you need 'em?
He mocks the darkness. His hateful voice flies like tiny bats through the iron bars in Jean-Baptiste's door. Words flutter around him, and he waves them off with sweeps of his hairy hands.
Did you know you get crazy in here, Hairball? If you don't get out, you're crazy as a cat with M-40s up his ass. You know that, Hairball?
Je ne comprends pas,
Jean-Baptiste whispers, a drop of blood running down his chin and disappearing in his baby-fine hair. He feels for the blood and licks his finger.
Oh, you comprende vous, all right. Maybe they stick something up your ass, huh? And kaboom!
Beast softly laughs.
See, once they get you over there in that cage, they can do whatever the fuck they like, and who's gonna know? You snitch and they hurt you more and say you did it to yourself.
Who's there?
I'm so fucking sick of you saying that knock-knock shit, mini-me dick. You know damn well who's there.
'Tis me, your buddy.
Jean-Baptiste hears Beast breathing. His air travels past two cells, and Jean-Baptiste smells garlic and red burgundy, a young Clos de Mouche, what he calls a stupid wine, because it has not slept long enough in dark, damp places to become brilliant and wise. In the dark, Jean-Baptiste's death row cell is his cave.
But here's the thing, my special pal, your only pal. They gotta transport me in this van to where they do me. Huntsville. What a name! Hunted and a villain, right? Takes an hour, the ride. What if something happens between point A and B?
At Place Dauphine, chestnut trees, azaleas, and roses are blossoming and blooming. Jean-Baptiste does not need to see, only to smell to know where he is. Bar du Caveau and Restaurant Paul, which is a good one. People are disconnected from him, eating and drinking behind glass, smiling and laughing, or intensely leaning into candlelight. Some of them will leave and make love, not knowing they are watched. Jean-Baptiste glides through the night to the tip of the Île Saint-Louis, and the lights of Paris are caught in the current of the Seine and shimmer like fine hair. In but a few minutes he is a mile or so from the morgue.
Now I ain't got the wherewithal to do nothing. Bet you do, though. You get that van stopped when I'm on my way to the needle, and I'll come back for you, Hairball. My time's up. 3 days. You hear that? 3 goddamn days. I know you can figure out a way. You can arrange it, save my ass, and then we'll be partners.
Inside a brasserie on the Île Saint-Louis, he sat in a corner and stared out at a balcony crowded with flower pots, and a woman stepped out to look, perhaps at the blue sky and the river. She was very beautiful, and her windows were open to the fresh fall air. He remembered that she smelled like lavender. He thought she did.
You can have her when I'm done, Jay said as he sipped a Clos de Bèze of the Domaine Prieur Roch.
The wine hinted of smoked almonds. He slowly swirled the red burgundy, and it licked around the wide bowl of the glass like a warm tongue slowly licking in circles.
I know you want some.
Jay lifted the glass and laughed at the double entendre.
But you know how you get, mon frère.
You listening, Hairball? 3 fucking days. Just a few days before you, I'll make sure you got all the bitches you want out there. I'll bring 'em to you, long as you don't mind if I have my piece of 'em first, since you can't, right? So why shouldn't you share?
A pause, and Beast's voice turns sinister.
You listening to me, Hairball? Free as a bird.
So here we go, Jay said with a wink.
He set down his wine glass and said he'd be right back. Jean-Baptiste, clean-shaven with a cap pulled low over his face, was not to speak to anyone while Jay... He can't call him Jay. Jean-Paul was gone. Through the window, Jean-Baptiste watched his beautiful brother call up to the woman on the balcony. He was motioning, pointing, as if in need of directions, and she smiled and began to laugh at his antics. Instantly, she was overcome by his spell and disappeared back inside her apartment. Then his blessed brother was magically sitting in the booth again.
"Leave," he commanded Jean-Baptiste. "Her apartment is on the third floor."
He nodded toward it.
"You see where it is. Hide while she and I have a drink. She will be simple enough. You know what to do. Now get out of here and don't frighten anyone."
"You fucking ugly piece of hairy shit!"
Beast's hideous whisper drifts inside Jean-Baptiste's cell.
"You don't want to die, do you? Nobody wants to die except the people we do, when they can't take no more and start begging, right? Free as a bird. Just think of that. Free as a bird."
Jean-Baptiste envisions the woman doctor named Scarpetta. She will fall asleep in his arms, his eyes never leaving her, and she will be with him always. He strokes the letter she sent him, typed and brief, begging to come see him, asking for his help. He wishes she had written it by hand, so he could study every curve and contour of her sensual penmanship. Jean-Baptiste imagines her naked and sucks his tongue. 53. Thunder sounds like kettle drums in the distance, and clouds roll past the waning moon. Bev will not head back to Dutch Bayou until the storm passes, if it moves this far southeast, and the forecast on the car radio doesn't call for that. But she isn't ready to return to the boat landing. The lamb in the forest green Ford Explorer has followed an interesting route for the past 2 hours, and Bev can't figure it out. She, whoever she is, has cruised streets, and especially parking lots, for no reason that Bev can tell. Her guess is that the lamb had a fight with her man and refuses to go home right now, probably to worry him sick, one of those little games. Bev has been careful to keep her distance, to turn up side streets, to pull off in gas stations along Highway 19, then speed up. Several times Bev has passed the Explorer in the left lane, going ahead at least 10 miles, pulling off the highway, and waiting for her prey to get ahead of her again. Soon enough they pass through Baker, a tiny town with businesses that have strange names. Rafe's Po' Boy, Money Flash Cash, Crawfish Depot. The town vanishes like a mirage, and the stretch of highway becomes pitch dark. There is nothing out here, no lights, only trees, and a billboard that reads, "You Need Jesus." 54. Gator eyes remind Bev of periscopes fixing her in their sights before vanishing underwater, the color of weak coffee. Jay told her gators won't bother her unless she bothers them. He says the same about cotton mouths.
"Did you ask them their opinion? And if it's the truth, then how come cottonmouths come crashing out of the trees trying to get in the boat? And remember that movie we watched? Oh, what was it called?"
"Faces of Death," he replied, on this occasion amused instead of annoyed by her questions.
"Remember that game warden who fell in the lake and right there on camera this huge gator got him?"
"Cottonmouths don't fall into the boat unless you startle them," Jay explained. "And the gator got the game warden because the game warden was trying to get him."
That sounded reasonable enough, and Bev felt slightly reassured, until Jay smiled that cruel smile of his and did a complete about-face, and explained how she can tell if an animal or reptile is a predator, and therefore an aggressor, and therefore the fearless hunter.
"It's all in the eyes, baby," he said. "The eyes of predators are in front of the head like mine."
He pointed to his beautiful blue eyes.
"Like a gator's, like a cottonmouth's, like a tiger's. Us predators are going to look straight on for something to attack. The eyes of non-predators are more on the sides of the head, because how the hell is a rabbit going to defend itself against a gator, right? So the little bunny needs peripheral vision to see what's coming and run like hell." I've got predator eyes, Bev said. Pleased to know it, but not at all happy to hear that gators and cottonmouths are predators. Eyes like that, she realized, meant something's on the prowl, looking to hurt or kill. Predators, especially reptiles, aren't afraid of people. Shit. As far as Bev's concerned, she's no match for a gator or a snake. If she falls in the water or steps on a cottonmouth, who's going to win? Not her. Humans are the ultimate predator, Jay said, but we're complicated. A gator is always a gator. A snake's always a snake. A human can be a wolf or a lamb. Bev is a wolf. She feels her wolfish hot blood stirring as she glides past cypress knees jutting from the bayou like the ridges of a sea monster's back. The pretty blonde woman hog-tied on the floor of the boat squints in intermittent early morning sunlight. Wherever cypress roots break the surface, the water isn't deep, and Bev is vigilant as she motors slowly toward the fishing shack. Now and then her prisoner tries to shift her position to ease the terrible pain in her joints, and her labored breathing flares her nostrils, the gag around her mouth wetly sucking in and out. Bev doesn't know her name and warned her not to say it. This was hours ago inside the Cherokee, after the lamb realized she couldn't get out the passenger door, and if she tried to climb over the seat, Bev was going to shoot her. Then the lamb got chatty, trying to be friendly, trying to make Bev like her, going so far as to politely ask Bev's name. They all do that, and Bev always says the same thing. My name is none of your fucking business, and I don't want to know yours or a damn thing about you. The woman was instantly powerless, realizing that she wasn't going to talk her way out of whatever horror was in store for her. Names have only two purposes. Use them to manipulate people into feeling that their lives have value, and refuse to use them to cause people to feel that their lives have no value. Besides, Bev will learn a lot about this pretty little lamb soon enough when Jay monitors the news on his battery-powered radio.
Please don't hurt me, the lamb begs. I have family.
I'm not listening, Bev tells her. You know why? Because you're nothing but the catch of the day. Bev laughs, enjoying the strength of her own voice, because very soon she won't have a voice. Jay will. Once he takes possession of the lamb, there will be nothing left for Bev to do, except what he orders her to do or not to do. Mostly, Bev will watch, and thoughts of that overwhelm her with a compulsion to control and abuse while she can. She binds the lambs tighter than Jay does, tying ankles to wrists behind the back so the body is bowed, making it all the more difficult for the lamb's diaphragm to relax and contract as she struggles to breathe.
"Tell you what, honey," Bev says as she steers. "We're going to anchor right over there under those shade trees, and I'm going to cover you good with skeeter spray, every inch of you, because my man ain't going to want you swelled up and itching."
She laughs as her prisoner's eyes widen and tears flood her puffy red lids. This is the first the lambs heard mention of a man.
"Now you quit your bawling, honey. You need to look pretty, and right now you're looking like shit."
The lamb blinks hard, the gag making wet noises with each agonizing, rapid, shallow breath. Bev steers the boat closer to shore, cuts the engine, and drops anchor. She picks up the shotgun and scans the trees, checking for snakes. Satisfied that the only one in harm's way is her prisoner, she lays the pump-action shotgun on top of the tarp and places a boat cushion on the floor just inches from her cute little catch of the day, as she continues to call her. Bev digs in her beach bag and pulls out a plastic squirt bottle of insect repellent.
"What I'm going to do now is take off your gag and untie you," Bev says. "You know why I can be that nice, honey? Because you ain't got nowhere to go but overboard, and if you think about what's in these waters, you ain't likely to want to go for a little swim. Or how about the fish box?"
Bev opens the lid of the coffin-sized fish box. It is filled with ice.
"That'll keep you nice and fresh if you decide to get rowdy, and you're not going to do that, are you?"
The woman vigorously shakes her head and dryly says, "No," as the gag comes off.
"Thank you. Thank you," she says in a shaking voice, wetting her lips.
"Bet your joints are hurting like hell," Bev says, taking her time untying her.
My man Jay tied me up once, my ankles and wrists tied up tight together behind my back until I was bent like a pretzel, just like you. It turned him on, you know.
She tosses the rope on top of the tarp.
Well, you'll find out soon enough.
The woman rubs her raw ankles and wrists, trying to catch her breath. She reminds Bev of a cheerleader, one of those athletic blondes with pure prettiness like those in 17 magazine. She wears small, horn-rimmed glasses that make her look smart, and she's the right age, late 30s, maybe 40.
You go to college? Bev asks her.
Yes.
Good, that's real good.
She disappears inside her thoughts for a moment, a slack expression on her fleshy, weathered face.
Please, take me back. We've got money. We'll pay you whatever you want.
Bev's meanness snaps back into her eyes. Jay's smart and has money. The woman is smart and has money. She leans close to the woman, the whine of mosquitoes loud beneath the trees. Not far away, a fish splashes. The higher the sun gets, the hotter it is, and Bev's Hawaiian shirt is damp with sweat.
Money's not what this is about, Bev says as the woman stares at her, hope fading from her light blue eyes. Don't you know what this is about?
I didn't do anything to you. Please just let me go home and I'll never tell anyone. I won't ever do anything to get you into trouble. How could I, anyway? I don't know you.
Well, you're getting ready to know me, honey, Bev says, laying a rough, dry hand on the woman's neck and stroking it with her thumb. We're getting ready to know each other real good.
The woman blinks, wetting her chapped lips, as Bev's hand works its way down, touching the hollow of her neck, then down lower, exploring wherever she pleases. The woman sits rigidly and shuts her eyes. She jerks when Bev reaches under her clothing, unhooking her bra and back. Bev starts squeezing the insect repellent, rubbing it on the lamb's naked body, feeling her luscious firm flesh tremble like jello. Bev thinks of Jay and the bleached area of the floor beneath the bed, and she shoves the lamb hard, slamming her head into the outboard motor.
This book is continued on Disc 6.